From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Two brothers, we're told, ethnic Chechens, young, one now dead, both suspects in Monday's Boston Marathon bombing. Just after 5 p.m. yesterday, the FBI unveiled their photos, unnamed, to the world. The hours since have seen a wave of action, killing, lockdown, and intense security sweeps. This hour on Point, the latest and what we are learning out of Boston and far beyond. We're going to look at what is known in this hour about two suspects, one now dead, reportedly behind the attack on the Boston Marathon at the beginning of this week. The whole country paying close attention here, and we are as well. WBUR, where we're originating from in Boston, colleagues with me this hour, Martha Biebinger, who's been unfolding this story throughout the night. Martha, thank you very much for joining us.
Absolutely, Tom.
And my WBUR colleague, Carrie Goldberg, former Moscow correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Carrie, you've been following the background of these two brothers. Give us their names and what we know of their background as we speak today. And we should say, much of Boston locked down in this hour. Surrounding communities locked down. The governor asking people to stay in their homes. Businesses closed. Universities closed. Public transportation shut down. A highly, highly unusual night and day in Boston. Overnight, gunfire, a policeman dead, another seriously wounded. One of the two suspects, brothers, killed in gunfire. A sense of explosive somehow involved perhaps as well at that time. Carrie, give us their names and what we know at this point of their backgrounds.
So what we know, Tom, is that the older brother was Tamerlan Tsarnaev. The younger brother, who's still at large, Johar Tsarnaev, who is believed to be 19. I've been looking at the Russian media, in particular at Izvestia, which is a reliable source, to get a sense of their background. What it's looking like is that they came to America not from Chechnya, but from Dagestan, which is a region of Russia. They appear to have lived there for about a year or two in the capital.
Next door to Chechnya.
Yes, very close to Chechnya. And before that, it looks like the younger brother, Johar Tsarnaev, grew up initially as a young child in Kyrgyzstan, which is a Central Asian republic. Yeah, so it's all this sort of former Soviet Union puzzle pieces of these various republics, but none of where they lived precludes the probability, and we have been hearing this from many sources, that they were ethnic Chechens, and therefore they could have a Chechen agenda, possibly, behind what they're believed to have done. Now, there have been some very interesting reports from Russian social media. There's a site called Vkontakte, which is sort of like the Russian Facebook. And the younger brother, Johar, had a page on there in which he says that his world view is that he believes in career and money. Oh, no, sorry. His worldview is Islam. And he believes that the main thing in life is career and money. So it looks like a very typical, you know, teenager Facebook page, except for perhaps the Islam on the page.
So two brothers, ethnically Chechen, but with a roundabout background. And how long had they been in the United States?
So it appears they came in around 2001, 2002. They spent a year or so in Dagestan, and then the head of their school in Dagestan says that they left when Johar, the youngest one, was just out of first or second grade.
So they would have been quite young when they came. And in high school, at eventually Cambridge Ridge in Latin, across the river from us as we speak in Boston, the other eventually in community college, and a boxer, the older, now
That's
dead,
right.
Brother Tamerlan.
That's right. And in one Russian article, he is described as sort of a ne'er-do-well that I saw. And let me also share, again, this is from Izvestia, which is a generally reliable source. It's saying that everyone is looking at the brothers' social media presence to try to figure out what could suggest their attraction to radical Islam. They're finding things like Jokar's page had audio recordings of a Chechen bard named Timur Mutsuraev, who's banned in Russia because of the extremist content of his texts. And when they looked at Tamerlan Tsarnaev on YouTube, apparently he had an album titled Terrorist on his YouTube page.
Now, Martha Biebinger with us. We're looking at backgrounds here. But this is in the context of a very live and unfolding story in which the older brother, 26, Tamerlan, dead after a gunfight in the streets of communities neighboring Boston overnight, and the younger brother, Jakar, the object of an enormous manhunt as we speak. What do we know about the status of that manhunt, Martha?
It's a manhunt that has shut down communities all around Boston, affecting roughly a million people. It has suspended the bus and train service so that the impact is much wider even than the people who can't leave their house and aren't supposed to be driving around. We know that within the town of Watertown, where the older brother was shot and killed this morning, there is still massive SWAT team presence. Police officers combing through basements and houses.
Armored vehicles, groups of armed men going through this community, backyards, and you name it.
They are determined to find Johar, but so far, and this started at about 1 o'clock this morning, as you said, some 10 hours ago, we don't have anything.
We've got listeners calling in wondering about this case. Mario in New Orleans, Louisiana. Mario, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, two questions. First of all, I really don't think that they're that connected if they have to rob a 7-Eleven. You know, I mean, it doesn't seem like they have a lot of backing with that, number one. And number two, the very, very first guest you have on the first hour says something about not being Chechen, but from Kurdistan.
Yes. Yes, we have heard that. Of course, this is very fluid. But just to confirm, that was from a high school classmate. That was one view. But my colleague, Kerry Goldberg, is here. And we'll get to your earlier observations. Very interesting, Mario. But, Kerry, it does appear from what we're seeing in the Russian press that this is part of the background in a family that had moved around a lot.
Exactly. I mean, I think it can be very confusing because the former Soviet Union was divided into so many parts and there was tremendous movement of population all around that former country. And so very often you'll have people of one ethnicity living in another place. All indications are that they were ethnic Chechens.
But Martha, Mario's question goes to earlier in the evening. First, yesterday, the images, just the photos still grabbed from video released to the public, and then a robbery at a 7-Eleven that they're involved. Do we know exactly what happened there and how that what ran into the following events? Were they robbing the 7-Eleven?
The assumption right now is that, yes, they were robbing the 7-Eleven and that the police officer called to that disturbance was shot when he tried to intervene. He never even actually made it out of the car, as far as we know.
Was there evidence that he ever identified them?
No. No,
there's not. I think we may have the suspects here from those images.
No, it was hours later. So that robbery and that shooting happened at about 10:30 last night, and it wasn't until maybe 2 or 3 this morning that we had police actually start to make those connections between this unfolding of a series of violent events that happened in the Cambridge and then into Watertown area and the release of those photos and the suspects in the Marathon explosions.
Let me bring another voice in right here on this point from Cambridge, Massachusetts, across the river from Boston, where, as in many surrounding communities, people have been asked to stay indoors. But we have with us one of the country's foremost scholars on terrorism, Jessica Stern, lecturer in public policy at Harvard, faculty affiliate at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, author of Terror in the Name of God and The Ultimate Terrorists. Jessica Stern, you hear our caller from New Orleans saying if they're robbing a 7-Eleven, they don't look like they're very well connected to an international terrorist network. What about that observation? What do you say to that, Jessica?
Well, of course, this is all speculation, but I can speak in general about what we see in the West, young people getting radicalized, living in the West, somehow finding an identity with people they see as oppressed, in this case possibly their own ethnic group, perhaps. It's quite common for people to self-radicalize when they live in the West and actually develop a plan and an identity over the Internet. And they don't necessarily have funding from a central organization. That is something that we've seen a number of times.
Can you picture a young man self-radicalizing to this extent that they go from being high school students, at least one of them, described by classmates as affable, friendly, all-American in many ways, to planting bombs in the middle of innocent civilians? Can people go that whole distance on their own, just picking up recipes and notions from the web and beyond, Jessica?
Well, yes. I mean, one of the things that, well, there are a number of things that were so confusing about this, you know, why Boston, why the marathon? Well, I think we now have the answer, because they are local. So it's a combination
of... That's their world. That's their context.
That's their world. One world is Boston, and where they would have a lot of expertise and ability, you know, to plan logistics and so on. And at the same time, apparently, perhaps being motivated by a jihadi ideology, which I would say is kind of a fad among some youth in the West. I mean, it really has spread that way, and kids can certainly learn how to make that kind of bomb very easily on the Internet.
One thing to know that kind of recipe is out there. Another thing to pick it up, do it, undergo that risk. I mean, even though these were crude bombs, there's a lot that goes into putting it together, including risk to oneself, and then to walk through those crowds, to leave it. Again, these are suspects. We are not at the end of a criminal process or judicial process here. We're in the midst of a manhunt. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's an unusual day in Boston. We are following an unfolding story, a massive manhunt of two suspects, now one dead in a gunfight overnight, in the Boston Marathon bombing. Two young men, 19 and 26, we are told, lived in the United States for a long time, originally from the former Soviet Union, Russia, Dagestan, maybe Kyrgyzstan, ethnically Chechen. And more coming out sort of hour by hour about the background of these two young men. Tamerlan Tsarnaev, 26, dead after a gunfight, a dramatic night, a carjacking, an attempted theft apparently of a 7-Eleven across the river from Boston and Cambridge, Massachusetts. His younger brother, Jokar, still at large, enormous numbers of security, scouring Boston and surrounding communities at this hour. That area shut down. People asked by the governor to stay in their homes in half a dozen communities, including Boston. Public transportation shut down. Businesses asked in many communities to remain closed. Universities closed. Here's the governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, this morning on the search.
There is a massive manhunt underway, a lot of law enforcement involved in that.
A massive manhunt, to say the least. I'm joined in this hour by my WBUR colleagues, the NPR station here in Boston, Kerry Goldberg, former Moscow correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and Martha Biebinger, WBUR reporter who's been following this story throughout the night. Jessica Stern is with us as well, lecturer in public policy at Harvard, a specialist in terrorism, author of The Ultimate Terrorists and Terror in the Name of God. Here's sound from Boston local WBZ-TV talking with an unidentified former high school classmate of the suspects, saying that he had been in touch with them until about a year ago, and that as of then they were what this one-time fellow student called normal, American accents, very popular.
Honestly, the first impression of this kid is normal.
Yeah, real.
Regular American kid, you know what I mean? Like, you wouldn't assume, like, I've seen a lot of reports of, like, him, you know what I mean, them being maybe, like, outside of the society or, like, maybe, you know what I mean, like, different, you know what I mean? But these kids were really, like, normal. They social, you know what I mean? Social. They had friends. They weren't really, they didn't give any signs, really, that something like this would happen at all.
So much unknown at this hour, so much that is fluid, but we do know this, a very large manhunt underway, and one of two suspects now dead. WBUR's David Boeri joins us right now from I think he's in, David, are you in Cambridge across the river from Boston at this point, and what's the latest you know on the manhunt?
I am in Cambridge, Tom, and I'm outside Norfolk Street. The street's blocked on both ends by security. There's been heavy security here all this morning since they arrived around 7 o'clock and told people urgently, neighbors, you have to leave now. So they have gone into the house at 410. They've gone into the house where the brothers lived, and they've been looking at a car that belonged to the brothers, a minivan. They found what they considered a suspicious object inside, so that increased security dramatically. They have done a controlled detonation during the morning, and all the neighbors have been told, go, you can't stay here, you got to leave. So that's the situation here, Tom. And it's interesting because it's right straddles the Cambridge-Somerville line. And so on one side of the street, I look over to Cambridge, it's empty. It's devoid of people other than security people, the FBI, state, local police. And I look on the other side, Somerville, one block, and I see people in the street. It's rather dramatic.
This because the governor has asked Cambridge people to stay indoors, and apparently they're following that. Who exactly lived in this home, David?
What's interesting to find out, Tom, is that the boys and their parents and their sisters lived here. They've lived here since at least 2005, based on what neighbors say. The next-door neighbor said she arrived in 2005. They were there. The parents and the women in the family were described as traditional, practicing Muslims. The women wore the hijab. They didn't speak too much to neighbors. The boys, on the other hand, had an active life outside the house. Johan was, at least in the description of one of his teachers, was just a star, a sort of a magnet. He used to, the teacher said he was a sweetheart. He was athlete of the month at Cambridge Ringe and Latin High School in 2011 when he graduated. Very well liked. He went to college. He was described as a wrestler, among other things. The older brother, Tamron, was 26 years old, had a child. Whether he was married or not isn't clear, but the police had been involved because the situation, relationship, domestic problems resulted in an assault and battery charge a few years ago. But at one point, one of the people in the neighborhood said, he asked Johan, are you Turkish? Because you don't look Turkish. Since he was with a number of people who were Turks, they said, no, I'm Russian. Now, it's not clear what ethnicity. There were initial reports that the family may be Chechens, but it's not clear what ethnicity they actually are. Of course, it would be interesting, you know, Tom, when you think of Chechnya and what they've been through, and the fact that many people from Chechnya ended up in Turkey, but we don't know that. The boy, Johan, identified himself as Russian.
And David, for listeners around the country, if you would, just share a sense of the scale of the manhunt underway now for Johan, the younger brother.
Tom, I've in all my years reporting, I've never seen the likes of this. And this probably is as much of a picture, an example of what we have in post 9/11 America. Whole towns and small cities are shut down. People have been told stay indoors today. Huge blocks in Watertown where they're searching for Johan. Police are searching for Johan. Closed off. So essentially, they have taken this area, this vast area of towns and cities that are shut down, and rendered the landscape to the point that anybody who's out on the street is now a person of interest in the desperate search to find him.
David, stand by. I want to get a call from Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, if I may. We've got David calling from there. David in Hilton Head, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, great to be with you all. I had a real quick question for your panel. Mm-hmm. I was just especially thinking about all the lockdown and everything that's ongoing in Boston. I was just wondering what sort of future impact on civil liberties we foresee from the events of this. I mean, I'm thinking specifically about how we reacted with airports and whatnot after 9/11, and I will let you guys take that up and take my answer off the air.
I appreciate your call. David Boeri, you're talking about this massive lockdown. We're in the midst of a very active manhunt, and there's the civil liberties question.
Absolutely is there, and, you know, the reality is that after September 11th, people, Americans, clearly accepted a lot of lessening of civil liberties. I mean, that has happened, as we know, in many ways, in law enforcement of many laws. Privacy has been cut back. We know that Americans have largely accepted that. And today to see this scene, Tom, just reminds me of that in very stark terms. Now we have courts closed today. We have all sorts of businesses shut down. And it's because I think that in the 9/11 period of transition, all police departments came up with these worst-case scenarios, often based on weather catastrophes. What would we do? And suddenly, there's an opportunity here to employ the worst-case scenario, whether it's totally necessary or not, and I'm not faulting the police response or the search, the manhunt for Johann at all. But, yeah, it's on display. People are not on the streets.
Though, in fairness, we should say, David, that this is not compulsory. This is voluntary. These are businesses voluntarily not opening, people voluntarily not leaving home. It's being described as a lockdown, but it's not a legal curfew.
No, Tom, but people were urged. I mean, you know, it's the language that's used, and people were recommending, please stay indoors. I mean, I've heard that. And so although it's perhaps, you know, request, it's put in stark terms, I believe.
David, please stand by once more. Evan in Austin, Texas is calling. Evan, thank you for your call. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say I think you should be careful about speculating about the suspect's religion. I heard the term radical. And I just think that once you start that conversation, it's really hard to stop it. People have a lot of connotations associated with that. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, Evan, I appreciate your call. Everybody trying to understand motivation for such a drastic act this week. And now, Martha, Evan's right. People are saying, well, look at this YouTube page. Well, look at this Facebook posting. Well, look at this ethnic background. Look at this religious background. And conclusions will be drawn here. But what seems fair at this point? Is there anything that can be said at this point about motivation? Are there direct expressions by these young men that we can look to, Martha?
Well, Tom, you mentioned one earlier on about the lack of friends. You know, I think Jessica's comment.
That's different from saying, I'm a radical Islamic terrorist.
It is. But what we're doing right now is putting it all out there. We're mentioning Islam. We're mentioning the antisocial behavior that we saw in some cases. We're mentioning drifting away from the family that we heard from the uncle, trying to look at all of these factors that may have come into play here and figure out which ones took priority and to what degree.
Jessica, you're our terrorism expert. You hear the concern coming out of Austin, Texas. Let's be careful with labels. At the same time, people are looking, all right, who are the suspects? What is the background?
Yes. You know, in a few days, I'm sure we'll be able to speak more about what led to, or certainly speculate more intelligently about what led these boys to decide to carry out such a heinous crime. But I can speak generally about jihadis in the West, and the older brother apparently saying in a photo essay, "I don't have a single American friend." Imagine how confusing that is for an immigrant kid. This is the typical profile of a kid who gets drawn into a violent movement. I'm not saying that every kid who doesn't have a friend would join a violent movement, but we see kids who are very confused about their identity, who feel alienated. There's always a reason, in my view, and in this way I guess I differ from some of my colleagues. I think there's always a reason that individuals choose terrorism. There's a reason, you know, there may be a compelling narrative, political agenda, but there's a reason why one person is drawn to that narrative and another isn't.
But is it fair at this point, Jessica, you're using the phrase jihadis in the West and drawn into a violent movement. Do we know enough to assert either of those things? Part of a movement? Do we know that? Jihadis? Is that a fair characterization?
Not yet. I'm trying to speak in general about what I know about jihadis in the West. I think we you're right. We have to be very careful about jumping to conclusions about this particular case.
And we'll try and do that. David Bellori, I don't want to keep you. I know you've got reporting to do here. What's anticipated at this point? Do they have a feeling that they understand a radius in which the younger brother may be, or is that all a great unknown now?
No. No, I mean, they thought they had an area, and it's within an area, because they've cordoned a huge area off in which they thought their suspect was. It's not here in Somerville. I now see more people and coming out with assault gear. And boy, Tom, I've never seen the likes of the military vehicles that have been driving around Boston in the last couple of days. But it's more to Watertown now. And Tom, can I mention something that I think you'll find interesting?
Yes.
If you heard the press conference last night, I thought it was extraordinary that the special agent in charge of the FBI in Boston released the photos and never made a comment about ethnicity, never made a comment about skin color. He put those photographs out there. And I think that, by the way, is remarkably different from what happened, unfortunately, in many cases after 9/11, in which we reporters following police seem to be visiting a good many and perhaps a large percentage of the Arab Americans living in this area just because they were.
He let the pictures speak for themselves. That was quite notable and quite true, David. David Boeri with WBUR, reporter for the Boston's NPR news station on the streets of Cambridge, Massachusetts, is today in the midst of a massive manhunt. David, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Catherine in Marble Falls, Texas, is calling. Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi. I just had a quick question as to the possibility that the older brother had some way of compelling the participation of his younger brother through some sense of honor or duty or family obligation, that because it seems from what's emerging about the younger brother that he was very adapted and very much a part of society, and that he did not, you know, have an obvious political motive.
Right, described as the happy-go-lucky brother, and then a suspect in a bombing. Do we know anything about the relation between the two brothers at this point, Martha?
Not enough to say that it was family loyalty that would have swayed Johar to abandon his more American affiliations for the maybe more Chechen radical aspirations, if that's what they were, of the older brother. What we do know about the younger brother, though, is, as Jessica was saying earlier, is that he was at a very vulnerable time in life, a period when identity is very much in flux, particularly for a child of immigrant parents. And so there was a lot at play.
Still much so unknown here. Jessica, the fact that it's two brothers is very striking, though, and one a clear 6 or 7 years older than the other. You can imagine a power differential or a respect factor coming in here.
Yes, you can. And, you know, I think the more interesting cases in some ways are when one brother becomes a terrorist and the other becomes a doctor, because we have many of those cases as well. They're both subjected to the same political environment, and yet somehow the narrative is more compelling to one than the other.
Speaking earlier today at the U.S. State Department, Boston native and U.S. Secretary of State, now former Senator of Massachusetts John Kerry, talked about the Boston Marathon bombing tragedy.
In the past few days, we've seen the best and we've seen the worst of human behavior, and it's the best that all of us really want to focus on.
We're looking at what we know and what we do not in this hour as this story unfolds. My WBUR colleagues, Kerry Goldberg and Martha Biebinger, with me in the studio. With us from Cambridge, Massachusetts, Jessica Stern, one of the country's foremost experts on terrorism, author of Terror in the Name of God and The Ultimate Terrorist, with us from across the river. And with us right now from Washington, D.C., our old friend Sarah Chase, now a senior associate at the South Asia Program, Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. 2010, she was a special advisor, became a special advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, contributing to strategy policy on Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Arab Spring, has spent many years in Afghanistan and delivered many reports for NPR in her earlier time there. Sarah Chase, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for the opportunity, Tom.
We heard from you when the apparent Chechen element of background came to light in relation to these two young suspects. and it set you thinking about the Afghan situation and the role of Chechens that you have witnessed there. What can you tell us, Sarah?
Well, I have to say it didn't surprise me when this Chechen identity first came to light, but Chechens were the most significant non-Afghan element in the insurgency in Afghanistan, you know, starting about 2006, 2007 in that period. And you would frequently hear this from Afghans themselves who, you know, to be sure, might not have been very precise in knowing people's national origins, but they constantly were talking about Chechens. And indeed, as I came to have interactions with the U.S. military, I was located down in Kandahar, the former stronghold of the Taliban in the south. But the U.S. forces that were initially in the eastern part of the country along the border with Pakistan were frequently talking about having killed or captured Chechen fighters. Now, again, this is a very small, it's a kind of fringe, but the international, the non-Afghan fighters in that insurgency were frequently Chechen. I also remember a period, I think it was 2009, when there were a couple of proselytizers who were making the rounds. I ran a small business, a small factory. I had about 20 employees from the villages around Kandahar, and so we would every day be, you know, discussing what was going on. And I remember this period when there were a couple of proselytizers that people said were Chechen. Again, you know, the precision of that identification can't be verified. But what was quite interesting is they were not making a lot of headway. They didn't speak Pashto, which is the local language. And locals who are quite chauvinistic, you know, would confront them on issues of religious doctrine.
Yeah, but Sarah, let me ask you, you know, it's a long way from Afghanistan and Kandahar to Boylston Street in Boston and the Boston Marathon. How should we think about it? How do you make that leap?
Here's how I make the leap. And again, it's a leap. So, you know, let's again use all the appropriate caution that you've been using, you know, for several days now. But what I have seen is that in a couple of countries where there were, or regions where there were severe governmental crackdowns, Chechnya being one and Uzbekistan being another, it's almost as though the local and political dimension of the radicalism really got almost repressed out of existence. And you can think about it almost like, you know, the clouds of gases on a star that spin off. There would be people at the very radical fringes that would spin off and become embedded in the more internationalist jihadi elements that were functioning, particularly around the borders of Afghanistan. So the IMU, which is the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, is one of the most violent, virulent, and internationalist jihadi of the elements in this kind of al-Qaeda linked or related franchise.
It's, you know,
and
it's
Chechens also were very present. And so what I'm trying to say is I think there's a fringe part of the Chechen radical movement that has detached from the original political autonomous objectives of the Chechen movement.
And yet it's very frustrating to hear this interesting potential context, but in the more immediate context of a rapidly unfolding story where we don't know exactly what, if any, ties like this were out there. I mean, you get into clouds of gases spinning off from stars, and that is way beyond the bounds of American jurisprudence. On the other hand, we live in a very globally networked world. Let me get a call here. Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Steve. Steve is calling. Hi, you're on the air, Steve.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to comment. A few years ago, I had been reading, I can't remember exactly where, but that Chechens, the ethnic Chechens, the Islamist radicalized ones, were extremely attractive to al-Qaeda and were being sought out specifically because they can pass in our society. They have Western appearance, and yet you've got the Islamic radical ideology, and you also have that long-term war effort that's gone on there with the Russians, and so you have people who are used to working with IEDs and all sorts of other machinations of war and look like us, and that al-Qaeda was very interested in finding them, getting them into the training camps, And those would be the ideal people, of which they were very short, to plan in our society, to put on airliners, to get into a position where they can attack Western societies and be able to pass.
It's an interesting observation just about physical features, though, again, what exactly we can tie together here and what we can't, we don't know. But it's an interesting observation. One more, Lexington, South Carolina, another Steve on the line. Hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Hi.
What's your thoughts, Steve?
Well, I just returned from Afghanistan, and a majority of the foreign fighters that are recruited there, be it for religious belief or lack of opportunity to fight in their country, are finding a way across the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan.
And for, are you seeing a Chechen connection here, or just...
Absolutely. A majority of which are Chechen rebels, killed or captured, a great majority, northeast, the young lady spoke to. Definitely what we found, definitely developed intel and information from the personnel that was captured.
Steve, you're breaking up, but I think we got it. You're speaking to Sarah Chase point, and you're just back from Afghanistan saying, yes, you have witnessed this. Again, what can be tied together here and what is happenstance we do not know at this hour? Deborah in Austin, Texas. Deborah, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm frankly really frustrated about all the speculation about ethnicity, religion, and motive. I would like to remind people that 18 years ago today, there was a horrible explosion at the Murrah Building in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Committed by a radicalized teenager or radicalized young man.
Timothy McVeigh.
He was white.
Yes.
We didn't know anything about him either. We speculated that he might have been Arab. We speculated he might have had ties to some terrorist group. The problem with this is we know virtually nothing, and we impugn the character of an extraordinary number of people with Russian backgrounds, including my own, who are not born in the United States, who might have religious views that are different from ours. It, to me, is very troubling that the media is going down this path simply because these two young men emigrated from Chechnya or from Russia, and we know very little else about them.
I think we're trying to keep it all out there at this point, Deborah. I appreciate your point very much, and it is well taken. You know, this is not a place for a broad brush. At the same time, there's a hunger to understand, and we are learning details coming out here, again, about suspects, not tried and found guilty in a court of law, but suspects after a very high-profile crime. Sarah, this is not Afghanistan, and you hear that concern that within an American context, our caller from Austin, Texas, saying, hold your horses here, folks. There's so much that is unknown.
And as you just said, the point is very well taken and, you know, and an important one to bear in mind. That being said, I think it is important to look at what some patterns, recent patterns have been. I think it's a piece of information that is of value that the majority of fighters that have been captured and killed in Afghanistan that are not Afghans or Pakistanis are Chechens. I think that's a valuable point. What I would be really interested in knowing myself is where did this family come to the United States from? I mean, I think those are the types of questions that are really going to help us out in, you know, in sorting the wheat from the chaff.
But exactly to our caller's point, Sarah, exactly to Deborah's point, so what? You know where they came from. That does not necessarily tell you what they're thinking or feeling.
We don't know where they came from immediately. That's what I'm saying.
But
they
even if you did, even if you did, what difference would
that
make?
That's where you start. It does make a difference. That's where you can start making connections, where somebody may have, you know, trained in a camp, where somebody may have had specific experiences or encounters that would cause them to choose a violent path. I think that is precisely how you make the distinction between a Timothy McVeigh and Mohammed Atta, who flew, one of the planes out of Austin.
on 9/11.
Of course, with time and discovery, we do learn more, as we learned about Timothy McVeigh. We know much more right now than we knew just 12 hours ago or 24. Yeah. But in fairness, our knowledge is highly incomplete at this point.
And speculative.
Inevitably, though, there is more on the table. I mean, it was a much wider field of speculation, certainly yesterday, and we're trying to keep this to what's known in a context where people are very hungry to understand what's happening around them. Sarah Chase, I know we've caught you in the middle of your life there. We're grateful to you for taking a few minutes to be with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you, Tom, for your terrific coverage of this.
Sarah Chase, South Asia Program Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and long in Afghanistan. Kerry Goldberg, former Moscow correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, now at WBUR. I mean, you're thinking and looking at this background, listening to our listeners. On the one hand, they want to know, what do we know? What can we see here? On the other hand, let us not make of it more than we can.
Exactly right. There is a historical tradition in Russia of terrorist attacks by Chechens, but they're against the Russian authorities.
Yes.
You know, this has gone on ever since Russia moved on Chechnya, which is technically part of Russia.
In a brutal, brutal conflict.
Right, starting in the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. And since then, there have been occasional Chechen attacks, but always on Russian soil. So, you know, the foremost question in my mind is, if this is coming from some sort of Chechen agenda, why in America?
Jessica?
Well, it may not be a Chechen agenda. It's a terrorist agenda. And also, I think that al-Qaeda did make some inroads in attempting to co-opt what was a nationalist movement, a separatist movement for independence, which failed. But al-Qaeda did move in there, and it is clear that some Chechens and some Caucasians did decide to join what they see as a global jihad. So it's not necessarily a Chechen agenda, that it's a jihadi agenda. And clearly the United States is one attractive target for that agenda.
Jessica, this family, I mean, the reporting that we're seeing coming in, two boys, two girls, that they had come to the United States to seek refuge from the war in Chechnya, where this Islamist rebellion had been crushed by the Kremlin.
Yes, and we don't know from whom exactly they were seeking refuge. One thing I think is really important to remember is we do have people like Jihad Jane, who were jihadists, but certainly looked nothing like jihadists, blonde woman, or last summer, I interviewed Sweden's most famous neo-Nazi, who is half African and half English. He was adopted. So he had quite brown skin, and he is a famous neo-Nazi. So people don't necessarily look like they belong in a particular terrorist movement, and terrorist movements often deliberately recruit individuals who don't look like they would belong.
I mean, I think at this point, Martha, the FBI, as David Boyer was saying earlier, very careful last night not to put this in terms of ethnicity. Just put the pictures out. Let them speak for themselves. We are a country of every color and hue. The skin doesn't seem to be the issue here. The issue is a bombing and the effort to try and stop more violence and to try and understand who was responsible for that bombing. And maybe one day we'll know why.
We have not heard anything about an ethnic agenda from law enforcement authorities or a suggestion that there was a larger connection at all.
So what can we do but watch as one large American community remains locked down as we speak in this hour? Dead on Monday, dead again overnight, a police officer, another grievously wounded, a dead suspect, and one more at this hour on the run. And with a massive lockdown in Boston as authorities pursue that suspect. Grateful to all of you for being with us. Martha Biebinger, reporter for WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Kerry Goldberg, former Moscow correspondent with the Los Angeles Times, now also My colleague here at WBUR in Boston, Carrie, thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jessica Stern, author of Terror in the Name of God and The Ultimate Terrorists. Jessica, thank you for joining us this hour. Stay safe in Cambridge.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thank you for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.